You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
A special exhibition at the Frick Collection looks at the work of Rembrandt through the eyes of two important collectors, industrialist Henry Clay Frick and Dutch art historian Frederik Johannes Lucht. Rembrandt and his school masterworks from the Frick and Lucht collections is on view until May 15th, so you don't have all that much time. But I'm very pleased to welcome the curator of the show, Colin B. Bailey, back to our show. Hi.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Isn't this the second time the Frick has teamed up with the Lucht collection for a show?
It is. We had an exhibition with them in 2009 where we selected their French drawings of their holdings and we catalogued them. And we had such a happy relationship that we were able to continue it. And this time, in a way, even closer to Lucht's heart because he was such a scholar and a collector of Rembrandt.
Well, why do you think that the two collections work so well together? Do they share a similar sensibility? Or are they complementary?
It's an interesting question. You know, when Frick acquired his first Rembrandt, the Portrait of the Young Artist, no longer by Rembrandt, in 1899, Lucht was acquiring his first etching by Rembrandt for 3 guilders. The men were not of the same age or generation or wealth.
But both, he found it in a flea market.
Absolutely. And you know, Frick was making his first purchase at that time in the field of old masters. But both men had an eye for quality and excellence, and they were able to realize this in their collecting.
But can we learn about Rembrandt in a new way by comparing the two collections? Did they emphasize different aspects of the artist's work?
Absolutely. Frick was primarily a collector of paintings.
And masterpieces.
And masterworks.
And he sure collected a lot of paintings.
Them. And at the end of his life, Rembrandt was his favorite artist. He said apparently that if he could come back as anyone, he would like to come back as Rembrandt. And that railways were the Rembrandts of investment. For him, he was the biggest railway stockholder in the world. So he had an enormous admiration for Rembrandt. He did not have a feeling for drawings. He did not. He bought a few drawings by Rembrandt. At the end of his life, they're no longer called Rembrandt. Lucht, on the other hand, who came to art history as a scholar, as an auctioneer, as a dealer, he loved Rembrandt above all others. And his drawings, 20 drawings by the artist, are incomparable.
He also wrote a biography of the artist, didn't he?
At age 14, his first one, Lucht would go to the Rijksmuseum's print room and work as a volunteer and catalogue their drawings as a young man, and he decided to write a biography of Rembrandt using illustrated by himself after prints and drawings by
Where
Rembrandt.
Where is his collection housed?
His collection is housed on the Rue de Lille in Paris, just by the Assemblée Nationale, and it's the old residence of Turgot, the finance minister under Louis XVI, and it's now a place you can visit for exhibitions and to see the collection.
So it's open to the public.
Absolutely.
Have the Rembrandts in the Lucht collection been seen in this country before?
Some of them were seen in the Morgan in the 1970s. One of the reasons we were so excited about this project, after many years, the Lucht collection published a 2-volume catalogue of its Dutch drawings, Rembrandt and Rembrandt School, and that catalogue appeared in December, just in time for this show. So that's the celebration, too.
Before he started collecting Rembrandts, Frick concentrated on American artists, didn't he?
American artists, living artists.
And so he didn't have any Rembrandt peels. He just...
No, he would...
That would have been too early.
That's right. He had artists from Pittsburgh region. He had fashionable French artists like Bouguereau, Alma Tadema, artists we don't associate with Frick, actually. And then... As a sort of road to Damascus moment, he was able to buy his first Rembrandt in 1899.
So what happened to those other paintings? Are they in the basement or were they sold off?
You know, some of those pictures form the core of the Frick Art Museum and Historical House in Pittsburgh, and they can be seen there. Others, Frick in the end decided not to give to either museum, and some of them have come up on the market.
Now, was Rembrandt already considered the great master history at least has portrayed him for a while? I don't think he now is considered as great as he was in the past. Great artist. I don't know how to say this, but there was a time when Raphael and Rembrandt were the epitome, and then everybody else was a lesser artist. That's no longer the case. But was that the opinion when Frick started collecting? Was this a matter of also just getting the best?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. When you come and see our show, the five paintings in the Oval Room, you look at that room, four of those pictures were shown in 1898 in the coronation exhibition for Queen Wilhelmina in the Netherlands as spectacular Rembrandts, four of the five. All of them at that point were owned by European collectors. 30 years later, they've started to come to America in force. In that first exhibition in 1898, not a single loan from an American collection. By 1930, many of them over the water.
Well, I think what I was asking about is the prestige factor. Because, I mean, the Frick Collection is one of the great art collections of the world. And there are just so many masterpieces there. But I would assume that when the millionaires, American millionaires, started collecting, they just wanted to get the best. I have the money. I want the best.
They did that, and Frick did that. Frick, we have found out, was offered routinely almost every Rembrandt that was available, and he didn't say yes all the time by a long shot. Rembrandt was established as a sort of founding figure in 17th century art, particularly in America, for his portraits. And that's why we see so many of them in American collections.
You say the first Rembrandt he bought has been de-attributed.
It was de-attributed quite early on by the 1940s. It's a portrait of an artist by an unknown artist. But in 1899, everyone thought it was by Rembrandt, including Berenson, who pushed Mrs. Gardner to buy it. She couldn't afford it, she said. Frick was buying a blue chip picture. And in a way, I think the fact that he acquired it and it hung in his Pittsburgh house gave him a sense to see what he could then do next.
One of the most popular Rembrandts in the Frick is the Polish Rider. Wasn't that deattributed some years back?
The Polish Rider has had a checkered history in the 80s. Having been the success of the blockbuster show in 1898, when it was brought out from a private collection in the depths of Poland, after Frick acquired it in 1910, it remained one of the pilgrimage pieces at the Frick collection. In the 70s and 80s, there was a very serious movement by Dutch art historians to try and understand Rembrandt's oeuvre better and to understand his students' work better. And there was a sort of visitation by this group to all collections. The Frick, of course, played ball, and we made it very easy for them to examine the picture. And in an academic article, in a footnote, one of the members of this committee thought this picture might be by Willem Drost, who was a pupil of Rembrandt's. And the reasoning there was, in a way, that the surface, the finish, the condition of the picture troubled some of these specialists. Over the years, the Frick never changed the label. The Frick we were certainly interested to know more as much as we could, but we had confidence that this was by Rembrandt.
And I was doing this radio show at the time, and we talked about the deattribution of the Polish Rider at the time. And I said, well, whoever did it, he was very good. And that has to be a consideration because only a few artists could paint a painting of that quality.
And in fact, when you look in that room now and you see this very handsome portrait of the artist that we do not know who it's by, that picture has remained without an attribution. The Polish Rider is such a monumental picture.
And it's called the Polish Rider because it was bought in Poland?
It was, but it was bought in 1791 in Poland, but by two Poles who referred to it as a Cossack on horseback. So Polish, Cossack. We certainly know that the rider, this young man, is full of Polish attributes, his costume, his hat, his cloak. These we are sure of.
The centerpiece of the show is a self-portrait from 1658. And Rembrandt painted a lot of self-portraits over the course of his career just simply because he was his own best model?
He was his immediate model. He could be a touchstone for different styles, costumes, attributes. Downstairs in the show, we have 12 prints, self-portrait prints, to give you a sense of him as a younger man. The works in the late period are particularly moving, though, because these are not done for dissemination. These are not done to be reproduced. And the self-portrait at the Frick, where he is shown almost enthroned in this historical costume, this strange golden apron and this sash, it's a very moving picture.
What was going on in his life at the time?
Well, you know, the year or two before, he'd filed bankruptcy. A document was attached to his property. He had been a spendthrift and poor organizer of his goods, had to leave his house, had to sell his goods, and he moved to a downscale rented house in Amsterdam.
Even though he was one of the most celebrated artists of his time?
And I think also he was experiencing something that I think for contemporary art, for modern art, is quite familiar. His style, his rough manner, which had been so emulated and so copied and followed, was becoming somewhat old-fashioned. And a more classical, smooth, Frenchified language of high art was now the court style. And you have a sense that he's sort of having to almost push a little bit to make his language of art still current.
Wasn't this around the same time that Vermeer started becoming a noticed artist, although he never became as famous as Rembrandt?
That's right. And Vermeer's work from the 50s, so exactly at this time. And when we see those at the Frick Collection, it's an entirely different world. A language of painting that is so restrained and so seamless. And Rembrandt is like a rough master in comparison.
The self-portrait was recently underwent some major conservation treatment by Dorothy Mahon of the Metropolitan Museum. What was done to it?
Well, this was a marvelous treatment. Dorothy removed 9 layers of discolored varnish, one after the other, that had been applied to try and give the picture a little bit more light and brilliance, and over the time had themselves become dulled. When she removed these layers, the picture was in itself without any flaws. It had not suffered. There were no repaints or retouches or abrasions. And then she worked very patiently to return a surface. And it is the most stupendous transformation.
You mentioned the drawings and etchings. I was stunned by how small some of Rembrandt's etchings were and how just perfectly beautiful they are. I didn't realize I've always thought of him as an artist who worked big.
Right. Well, the first self-portrait etching we see is tiny, and he's shown as a sort of bad boy with his hair in disarray and a sort of pugnacious expression on his face. And time after time, it's almost the focus gets even smaller. There's something tremendously gutsy about that, I think.
There's a very beautiful drawing from the Luth collection called Interior with Saskia in Bed from 1640 to 1642. What was Saskia's relationship to Rembrandt?
Well, Saskia was his first wife. She was the cousin of his dealer, Van Eulenberg, who looked after him when he came to Amsterdam, and she was his devoted companion. She bore him several children, only one of whom lived to Titus, who lived, and she was his sort of helpmate. There's a beautiful portrait of her as well in one of the etchings where she is seated behind Rembrandt. He's looking out at us. She's his inspiration. And this beautiful drawing that you mentioned, it was Lucht's favorite drawing. It's almost a miniature painting. It's absolutely exquisite.
And she died fairly young.
She did. She died in 1642, which gives us a sort of sense of when this drawing may have been done. She's shown in confinement in a very elegant upholstered bed with a nursemaid looking after her. The feeling is that she's either just given birth or she may have just had a miscarriage, but there's something fragile and frail that Rembrandt has captured in this drawing.
Now, the show has been up for a while. What has been the response from experts in the field? Have they told you that they learn new things from looking at these two collections together?
Well, I think firstly, everyone is very excited to see the restored self-portrait and to see also the works that were Frick's Rembrandts that are no longer Rembrandt. And that's instructive.
By the way, it's easy to spot at least one of them.
Absolutely.
Anybody, you don't have to have a trained eye to note that the first one that he bought, that portrait, it really just is not up to Rembrandt's style.
But I think it's good to get that, to have that experience, to come into a room and be able to look without worrying about how much you know or you've read, and just let your eye and your instinct guide you, and then you do feel that. And that is part of the pleasure of being a collector, a curator. I think we've offered that. I also remind you that drawings, because of light restrictions, because of the way they are housed, are very rarely on public view for any time. And that's why a room of Rembrandt drawings followed by a room of his followers is very moving and instructive.
And it's going to be on view only until May 15th. And then the Luth collection go back to Paris?
The Luth collection does go back to Paris. But let me just tell you, we are holding on to those drawings for one more week. the paintings and etchings will have to come down because we are installing another exhibition, but the drawings will stay downstairs until the 22nd of May.
And one of the upcoming exhibitions is of another one of the Frick's great masterpieces by Giovanni Bellini.
Oh, that's a thrilling one picture blockbuster, if you like. We're going to show that picture in a new way and also introduce you to the technical, extremely interesting technical examination that the Met, Charlotte Hale at the Met, underwent with our Mellon fellow, Susanna Rutherglen. They've worked on this for months, and the results of this investigation are going to be available to us.
You said that that Frick chose the Rembrandts in the collection. Are most of those great paintings in the collection that Bellini, the Holbein that has faced it for many years, were they all chosen by him, or did he just have some experts who said, Mr. Frick, you got to buy this painting?
He made the decision. Things were brought to his attention all the time, and we know how much he passed on certain works. That great self-portrait, the dealer Charles Carstairs said, I have imagined it over your mantelpiece, dominating the room, just as you dominate everyone you see. And I think that was a good sell, but Frick made the final decision.
It must have been wonderful living in a house with all of those great paintings. Now we have an opportunity to see them in what may be the most perfect little museum in the world, the Frick Collection. My great thanks to Colin B. Bailey, who is the curator of this show called Rembrandt and His School, Masterworks from the Frick and Luck Collections, on display, unfortunately, only until May 15th. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you.